Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. If we read poll after poll, it's pretty clear that many Americans are not pleased with where we are as a country. It's true, we have made strides in certain areas, but when thinking about environmental degradation, political and religious extremism, income inequality, and of course, COVID, folks are not always believing in a bright future. We're told by historians that everything is cyclical, that we've been down this road before. If that's true, then it means that things did get better at some point, obviously. Something had to shift for that to happen. In their new book, Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again, authors Shailen Romney Garrett and Robert Putnam trace our country's growth from a very challenging period in the later 19th century to a certainly flawed but more enlightened era, and all the way to the dismal time we're in right now. But they do offer hope that if certain dials are turned the correct way, we can come out on the other side intact. With us today is co-author Shailen Romney Garrett to discuss her findings and the role religion and spirituality have played along the way. A bit about Shailen: she is a social entrepreneur. Her degree is in government from Harvard. She spent time in the Peace Corps and is a founding contributor to David Brooks' Aspen Institute initiative, WEAVE, the Social Fabric Project. Her writing has appeared in Time Magazine, the New York Times, as well as other publications. You can read more about her efforts on her blog, Project Reconnect. And besides the book we're talking about today, Shailen contributed to American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, which won Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson Award for Best Political Science Book in 2010 and 11. So we welcome to Common Threads, Shailen Romney Garrett. Hello, Shailen.
Hi there. It's great to be here.
Well, we're thrilled you can make it. First question, right out of the gate: what is a social entrepreneur?
You know, a social entrepreneur is someone who starts a new initiative or potentially sees a way to solve what I would call society's most pressing problems. So instead of being an entrepreneur whose aim is to make money or bring value to investors, a social entrepreneur is someone who is interested in solving problems and bringing a broader value to society through ideas that maybe have never been tried before.
That's one of the most concise and intelligent answers I've ever heard. to a term that is at least new to me, and I would suspect others as well. Then that makes me aware that I am surrounded by social entrepreneurs. That's great. So let's start talking about the book Upswing. Now, it's called Upswing because you start from a particular point, which is not too pleasant. Then there is a rise. And so it's sort of a bell, it's a bell curve of sorts. We rise and then we come back down. In the book, where do you start? Where is the down period that you start approximately a century plus ago?
So really the book, I mean, to a certain extent, the impetus of the book was looking at today, right? That picture that you sort of painted in the introduction of where we are today, which is in a place where, you know, the vast majority of Americans think that we're on the wrong track. In fact, the survey data that I've seen, that wrong track measure reached an all-time high and shortly after the January 6th incident. So Americans just think that something's gone wrong, and they're not wrong to think that. You know, from the statistical perspective, we are extraordinarily economically unequal. We are incredibly politically divided. Our social fabric is in tatters, and you know, we have an incredibly narcissistic culture. So in some sense, the impetus of the book started with today, saying, how did we get here? And really, there have been a lot of books in the last maybe decade attempting to answer that question by looking back only so far, by looking back maybe a half century over this period that we might call a sort of fall from grace. So there's a lot of books that sort of hark back to this mid-century era in American history that was supposedly this better America. And that actually turns out to be true statistically. But what Professor Putnam and I are doing in this book, The Upswing, is saying, well, what if we zoom that lens out even more broadly? Because if there was a time at mid-century that was, by all of these different measures, economics, politics, society, and culture, that it was such a better situation than we're in today, how did we get to that better situation? And that actually led us to the discovery that about 120, 125 years ago, at the turn of the 20th century, America was actually in a remarkably, I would even say breathtakingly similar situation to where we are today. And you can actually not, we're not just saying that like, oh, I look out my window and America maybe looks, you know, like historically we're in a set of similar circumstances. You can actually measure that statistically. And of course, Robert Putnam is a leading social scientist. He is the data mind behind this book. And he really made this breathtaking discovery that by hard measures, America was in a remarkably similar place of polarization, inequality, narcissism, loneliness, despair, as we are today. So then we went through this period of an upswing, followed by a downturn, and that's the story of the book.
And so give us some of the parallels from back then and now. So we're talking approximately 1900, right? That this is the low point that we're starting at.
Sure. And even earlier than that, I mean, so we're talking about what Mark Twain disparagingly called the Gilded Age in American history. And that was, you know, in the late 1800s. And that was a period of unprecedented prosperity, unprecedented educational opportunity, and really unprecedented personal freedom, much as we see today. But that came along with extreme income inequality and class segregation. An economy ruled by corporate monopolies, workers powerless to negotiate for themselves, raw materials being gobbled up, pollution choking air and waterways, contaminated products making it into the market, really an economics that was just about what can be gained, not what can be contributed. And then in politics, it was a relentless zero-sum power struggle. Does that sound familiar?
A
repeated failure of compromise. You know, we just had politicians that seemed like they couldn't get anything done. And so populism and socialism became popular alternatives to a two-party system. And there was a lot of cynicism back then about a rigged system. And then when you look at the social fabric, rife with loneliness and isolation, social dislocation, we had a lot of nativism, a lot of suspicion of immigrants, sort of a battening down the hatches type of a mindset, and a real like disillusionment and despair. A lot of commentators saying that America had sort of gone off the rails, that maybe this was the end of the democratic experiment. And then also we had a culture of extreme, I guess you would call it extreme self-reliance. There, you know, people really believed this social ideology called social Darwinism, which, you know, at the time was taking the ideas of Charles Darwin, the survival of the fittest, and saying not only does that apply to the natural world, but that's actually a good way to organize society. Darwin himself did not subscribe to that, but it was something that was sort of created in his name to justify, the winner take all and devil take the hindmost kind of mindset. So it was extremely narcissistic. And it was a rough time in American history that actually looks amazingly familiar to what we see today.
It's interesting, too, because when you think about this survival of the fittest, so to speak, I'm curious to know if those people, how those people thought about inherited wealth. You know, is someone who inherits wealth and position more appropriate for the country's growth than someone who is at the bottom rungs of society and perhaps can't even get to the next rung because of the person with inherited wealth squashing their chances one way or the other. Yeah, that is quite fascinating. I'm curious, in the book, does the Spanish-American War come up at all? Is there any way in that affects the mood of the country and the direction of the country?
You know, we don't address that specifically. And a lot of questions come up with regard to this book of sort of how does war influence the turning point in this story, right? So on the heels of this time of the Gilded Age, which was just this sort of mess that America was in, and everyone sort of decrying the end of democracy, that didn't happen. What happened instead was that we entered this pivot point that ushered in a multifaceted upswing that lasted 60 to 70 years until roughly in the 1960s, all of these measures, economics, society, politics, and culture that we're using as the baseline here, that were moving in a positive direction for 60 to 70 years, turned back the other way and started down in a negative direction. And so a lot of times people say, what effect did wars have on this? Are wars times when people turn against each other? Are they times when people turn towards solidarity? You know, and the answer to that is yes, those events or crises do to a certain extent affect this. However, these trends don't map on to the sort of that historical idea quite as cleanly as you might think, if that makes sense.
No,
and that's maybe more clearly illustrated when you're looking at things like World War II or the Vietnam War. But so I'm not sure if that answers your question. But
No.
It's something that does come up often.
Sure, it does. And you say that income equality or this downward trend started in the mid '60s, and when I read that, I was kind of surprised because I thought that the turning point was in the early 80s with the Reagan administration. But you say that that's not true, that it actually started at least a decade before. Is there any particular event or set of events that may have caused that to happen that you're aware of?
Well, so you're right in saying that what we show in the book from the hard data is that actually the country reached a sort of peak of economic equality in roughly actually the year is about 1960 for this particular set of measures. And then it starts to turn downward. And that downward trend accelerates. It gets a lot steeper in the 1980s. But it was already on its way down. And so to a certain extent, you might say Reagan was, in a way, a product of a trend that was already heading in a certain direction. Maybe he sort of saw a parade and got out in front of it. Does that make sense?
Sure.
In terms of people wanting a society that was more eye-focused rather than more focused on sharing the pie, right? And in answer to your question of what caused that turn, what's interesting is that people often look at the economic piece of this study and think, well, that certainly would be the one that turned first, right? We have this, I think in general, we sort of have this vaguely Marxist idea of history that economics drives everything, right? And then when the economics turns, then the politics turns, and then the culture turns, and this sort of thing. What actually turns out to be interesting is that it's really hard to say what's the leading and lagging indicator. It's really hard to look and identify specific causes. But one thing that we do see for sure is that economics is a lagging indicator, both in terms of turning upward in the better direction during the upswing and also turning downward in this more unequal direction during the downturn. And so it may be that other things such as politics or culture or, you know, were shifting that actually brought the economic inequality along with it, which I think is a surprising finding to a lot of people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU. My name is Fred Stella, and with me today is Shailen Romney Garrett. We're talking about the book Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago, and How We Can Do It Again. So if economics is the lagging indicator, from what I'm understanding, you're speculating on what the leading indicators are. Do you have any clues as to where we might look for that that downturn in the mid-60s?
So anyone who lived through the 1960s knows that that was sort of a moment of, as my co-author Bob Putnam likes to put it, who did live through that period, America going through a sort of nervous breakdown. You know, I mean, I don't know if that captures it for some of your listeners, but it was really sort of this concatenation of crises, right? And to some extent, that was driven a bit by backlash to the civil rights movement. So I should back up just a little bit and say, when we tell this story of this sort of Gilded Age, then through the Progressive Era, we enter a long upswing that sort of reaches a peak in mid-century America and then turns back down into this downturn that lands us back into this multifaceted crisis that we're in today. What happened at the peak of that, what Bob and I often describe this curve as, is the I curve. So America was in a very I-focused moment culturally, in terms of, you know, economics, all these other things at the beginning of the century. Then we moved in a direction toward we, and then we moved back down toward I as we get to today. So that peak of we-ness in the mid-century America, that was the moment when we finally achieved a sort of fragile national consensus around widening the we, bringing more traditionally excluded groups into the we, in terms of civil rights legislation and the women's movement and these sorts of things. And when you look at the survey data, people were in favor of those things in principle. But shortly on the heels of the passage of civil rights legislation, many white Americans went into a sort of not in my backyard moment. They felt that Johnson administration was moving too quickly on implementing integration, these sorts of things. And so, there was a huge white backlash to this peak of American we-ness when we sort of widened that we. And what that says to me is that under the surface of this upswing, there was a lot of work that was left undone. We did not do the work of racial reconciliation during the upswing. And that's partly a story of the fact that these progressive era reformers, who in the book we argue really drove this upswing, were in many ways, many of them were racist. Their circle of moral concern did not extend quite far enough. And so the we that was building during this period was a highly racialized we. We tried to sort of ameliorate that with legislation at mid-century, but we hadn't done the heart work underneath to really achieve the racial reconciliation. And so to a certain extent, this upswing had knit into it the seeds of its own demise. And in some sense, you might say then that that white backlash was a huge part of what precipitated the downturn. Now, whether the white backlash drove the downturn, whether other things drove it and the white backlash came right along with it, that's really hard to tease out of data. You can't really say exactly, but it certainly is a huge part of what was going on at that moment.
That's interesting, because I've heard before from social scientists social activists, that the important thing always is just to get the darn legislation passed and made into law, and then public consensus will follow. That's how it works. But you're saying you have a different take on this, that perhaps other work should, groundwork should have been laid along with or before the legislation. Am I hearing that correctly?
Well, to answer that question, let's go back and look at what did go right during the upswing. Okay, so we've talked about how one of the negative lessons of the upswing is that racial inclusion, that groundwork was not done. But let's look at the positive lessons of that era to maybe answer this question. When people tend to think of the progressive era, they think of Teddy Roosevelt. They think of the national income tax being instituted and child labor legislation and trust busting and all of these things that were widely agreed upon at the time as good for society. But those things, again, speaking of leads and lags, those things were the lagging indicator. This progressive movement, and again, I should emphasize we're talking about capital P progressivism, which is a different way of using that term than we would use it today. Today, progressive indicates the farthest left end of the political spectrum. But back then, to be progressive meant to subscribe to a set of ideas that actually were quite attractive to both parties. During the 1912 election, all three presidential candidates were sort of jockeying for the term progressive. I'm the progressive candidate. No, I am. You should vote for me. So it was a broad movement. Historians have called it, you know, so diverse as to barely be coherent, right? But what it was a movement of people who were beginning to say, America has gotten off the rails in terms of our values. We need to reevaluate the values upon which America is founded and let our policies and our legislation flow from that. And so going back to what we'd mentioned about social Darwinism, that was directly challenged in the late 1800s with a movement called the Social Gospel Movement, which came out of evangelical Protestantism, but ultimately became more of a broad cultural phenomenon to say, look, society's not some giant competition. That's an erroneous view of who we are. Society is actually about what we can do for each other, how we can cooperate, what we can build together. It's about the idea that we're all in this together. That's what defines a society. And so people began to take on that mindset, to experience that moral awakening and that moral shift. And that actually is fairly clear, both from the data and from the historical record, as the thing that turned first during the last upswing. So when you want to talk about what drove this 70-year multifaceted moment when all of these trends were going in the right direction, Bob and I tend to think that it was actually the moral work, the heart work, that began to happen first, which is a strange thing for a social scientist to say. In fact, you know, I think sometimes I hear Bob feeling like he kind of has to like apologize for that finding, because it's such, it does go so against the grain of what you normally hear from social scientists who study this stuff. And I think to Bob, it was a shock.
It's
fascinating.
Yeah, and I do want to get more into the religious and spiritual underpinnings of our upswing and the downturn as well. But I think we'll save that for next week, because we're coming close to the wire on this episode. However, before I let you go, tell us the story of how the both of you discovered how much the word we was used and how much the word I was used in publications over a century of American work.
Sure. So the story of this book is an interesting one, because, you know, Professor Putnam is famous for writing Bowling Alone, which was the seminal work that really discovered the decline in American community over the course of the last 50 to 60 years. That book was published in 2000. And so in a sense, Bowling Alone was about just the downturn piece of this curve and just the society indicators. It wasn't about economics or politics or anything else. So Bob began to broaden that lens and say, well, what was happening during that same period on these other metrics, economics, politics, culture? And then he began to say, well, what was happening before the downturn? And that's how he discovered these remarkable confluence of curves. But on the culture question, you know, how do you measure culture? You know, how do you measure whether we're more of an I-focused culture or more of a we-focused culture? And actually, Bob discovered this set of data called N-gram data. Google has actually digitized almost all of the books written in the English language for going back hundreds of years. And we're talking about all books, not just academic books. We're talking about gardening books and cookbooks and religious books and self-help books and all sorts of things. And you can actually search through the digitization process the frequency of different words. So Bob searched for the most basic measure of community versus individualism, which would be the usage of the word, the pronoun I versus the pronoun we. And when you track those as a ratio, over this 120, 125 year period that we're looking at, it was a startling finding that it tracks the exact same inverted U curve as we see in economics and as we see in politics and as we see in social capital. So that was a really breathtaking moment for Bob. I remember it very clearly because I remember him sort of telling me about this wild-eyed over the dinner table as we were sort of catching up, having not seen each other for a long time. And that was the moment that I knew this was a book and that there was a real story here. And later, I became a part of the team that brought this book to life. But that was a fascinating way to put a hard measure around whether we're an I-oriented society or a we-oriented society and how that has changed over time.
That is an impressive story. Shaylin, I want to thank you so much for your time with us today. We are down to the wire right now, but I'd love to have you come back next week and we can continue our conversation.
Great. Sounds wonderful.
I'm Fred Stella. You've been listening to Common Threads here on WGVU-FM. My guest today has been Shaylin Romney Garrett. She is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam, of the book Upswing: How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Please join us next week.